Okay. Hare Krishna. So thank you all very much for inviting me here to Manchester. This is what, Friday the 16th? And we're just here for the one night, yeah? Okay. So I've been travelling around a little bit. I've already been to Soho Street and Newcastle, Coventry. Last night we were in Leicester. And I've been just sharing with the devotees a little bit of the experiences and information about Srila Prabhupada, what it was like to be with Prabhupada. And in particular, I've been presenting this seminar called Srila Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam. And the idea is to give the devotees a chance to see how Srila Prabhupada was practicing devotional service. How he was, you know, not just speaking the philosophy, but how he was living it. And because there are many different aspects to devotional life. And what I did was I took different topics like prasadam or chanting, cleanliness, health, book writing and publishing, etc. And whatever Prabhupada said or did, at least during the year and a half that I was traveling with him, then I've compiled those into different segments for this seminar. We were the last few nights in Coventry and in Leicester last night talking about Prabhupada's publishing activities, because Prabhupada said that books are the basis, and he many times said that his main devotional service was the writing of his Srimad Bhagavatams and his other books. So that's a, it's a very important aspect, of course, of Krishna consciousness. It's what Prabhupada once described as our family business, all the way from back to Lord Chaitanya's time, Srila Rupa Goswami, Jiva Goswami, and then later on Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Narottam Das Thakur, etc. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and of course Srila Prabhupada. Writing and publishing has been, you know, the essence of the Krishna consciousness movement. That's how, you know, everything is passed down to the future generations. So Prabhupada considered writing to be very important. And he especially wanted to try to impress that on his disciples, that we also had to take up this family business of presenting Krishna consciousness. According, he said, you write according to your realization. Whatever you can, you've understood, you write that down. That will be beneficial for you, and it will also be beneficial for others that get to read that. So following in that tradition, I've been trying to present a little something about Srila Prabhupada. I traveled with Prabhupada from late November 1975 until about the end of March in 1977. So that was about 16 months, and then I had a couple of months with Prabhupada later on, just before his departure in November of 1977. So during the period that I was traveling with Prabhupada, I was keeping a diary, somehow or another, right from the very first night that I was asked to give Prabhupada his massage in New Delhi. Krishna gave me sufficient presence of mind to start keeping a diary. And once I started that, then I maintained that for the whole period that I was traveling with him. Originally, I was thinking, you know, that it was, I was keeping these notes for my own benefit, so that in the future, then I'd be able to look back and, you know, read those notes and recall all the, you know, wonderful activities that Srila Prabhupada had performed. But after a short while, then I realized actually it was also a historical document, that what Srila Prabhupada was doing is going to make its a very definite mark in history. Prabhupada himself also said that. We were traveling on the train from Allahabad 1977 in January. We'd been to the Kumbh Mela, and we were going overnight to Calcutta. Myself and Rameshwara Swami were with Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada himself said that history will mark this period when the Krishna consciousness movement spread all over the world and saved the world. So Prabhupada had a historical perspective on what he was doing. Although on the one hand, he had no expectations. When he went to the West in 1965, he told me that, he said, "I didn't go there to become successful." He said, "I just went there because it was the instructions of my Guru Maharaj, and I went there for his pleasure, just to execute my, it was just a question of doing my duty." So he had no expectation. And sometimes he said, "I was surprised at the success of the Krishna consciousness movement, how it spread, and how many books were being distributed." But then on the other hand, he also had this sense that what he was doing, you know, because it was completely under Krishna's direction, and he had this sense that it was a historical event. And he had a tremendous ambition also for spreading Krishna consciousness. We were in Mayapur in 1977, and it was just before Prabhupada got really, you know, seriously ill. And that illness, you know, basically speaking, he never really recovered from that. But one morning, Prabhupada was standing on the balcony. We were looking out over the fields in Mayapur there. And he told me, he said, "I want to spread Krishna consciousness everywhere at once." So that was his ambition. He wanted to see Krishna consciousness established everywhere at once. So there was a kind of enthusiasm for that. And then, as I say, on the other hand, he had no real expectation of doing anything, and he was, you know, always kind of amazed at how successful he had actually been. Anyway, so those are kind of two features of a pure devotee, that he tries his best. He has every hope that he'll be successful because he's doing it for Krishna. But on the other hand, he doesn't have any real expectation that what he's doing will be successful. It all depends on Krishna's mercy and what Krishna wants. So Prabhupada was just surrendered to Krishna's desire and the desire of his spiritual master. And he left everything, the results of what he was doing, to them. So he was engaging us also, of course, in preaching work. And one of the main things that he wanted us to do was to, you know, become writers, to be able to present Krishna consciousness. One of his criticisms of his own god brothers was that they never wrote any books. He said that when we were in Calcutta in 1976, he made a comment. He said that after 40 years, he said, "My god brothers are still selling Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's books, only his books. They had no other books." So it's good that they were selling Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's books, but they had no books of their own, and after 40 years they'd not made a contribution. Whereas Prabhupada, you know, regarded book writing as being his main contribution. He said, "That will be our lasting contribution to the world, this Srimad Bhagavatam presentation." So anyway, I joined Prabhupada's party, as I say, in late November 1975, and one of the devotees that was also on Prabhupada's party at that time was Hari Kesh. He was a brahmachari at that time. And he was transcribing Prabhupada's evening dictations. Prabhupada would work through the night from about 12 until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. That was when he was doing all of his writing. He would translate the Bhagavatam and then make his commentaries. And Hari Kesh, his service was transcribing the tapes from those dictations, and he was also Prabhupada's cook at that time. So anyway, when I joined the party, there were certain services that Hari Kesh was doing, personal services for Prabhupada, which he had then to hand over to me. So initially he was a little, you know, kind of apprehensive that he was losing some of his service, and you know, maybe then Prabhupada would send him off, you know, to get some other engagement somewhere else, you know, doing some preaching work to more fully engage him. But actually what happened was that Prabhupada gave him a new service to add to what he was doing with cooking and transcribing, and that was writing. And he personally supervised his attempts at writing, and in particular he gave him a particular topic, and that was writing against material science. And not just material science, but he trained him in how to defeat communist philosophy. Because the communist state was based on, they had an official creed of scientific materialism. That was the official state philosophy on which communism was based. So Prabhupada was very keen, you know, to expose the flaws and defects in material science. Hare Krishna. So this is on December the 6th, 1975. Srila Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. Prabhupada has given Harikesh a new service. I'd been with Prabhupada about a week at this point. He wants him to write an essay entitled Experimental Knowledge, which explains the defects of modern science and presenting the scientific basis of Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada has been personally coaching him, calling him in regularly to discuss points of logic. He told Harikesh not to criticize modern science as such, but the misuse of it. Science should not be used as a tool to propagate atheistic theories, and false claims must be exposed. He said modern scientists are challenging God, and now we have to challenge the modern scientists as God's representatives. He said, inventions you can take credit for, but why claim to be God? So Prabhupada was very keen to get into this, and he was calling in Harikesh every day practically and having him read back whatever he had written the day before. And on morning walks also, he would engage him in debates and he would challenge him. And Harikesh would play the part of the scientist and Prabhupada would, you know, smash all of his arguments. So it was very nice. So this was going on for about a month. On December 25th, 1975, we flew up to Ahmedabad, and then we drove out to a place called Sanand, which was a town of about 20,000 people, about an hour out of Ahmedabad. And we were staying there at the King of Sanand's palace. So, because it sounds very grand, it was actually very kind of fairly simple by our standards. It's not like Buckingham Palace or something like that. But it was the biggest house in town, basically. Three stories, red brick. And the King of Sanand was a very nice man. He used to invite sadhus to come to his town and put these pandals on. So they'd been very impressed with Prabhupada and his foreign disciples. And they'd invited him up there. So we did a five-day pandal. So on December the 27th, although Prabhupada was going out in the pandal, and when Prabhupada was traveling, he always insisted that his servant and secretaries must attend, you know, the morning walks, they must attend all the temple programs, and they must attend all of his lectures, at least that much. And the only person that really was given a little leniency on that was the servant. He was not required to go for Mangal Aarti. Somebody had to be in the house where Prabhupada was staying at all times. But the secretary, maybe Pradyumna, who's the Sanskrit editor, and whoever else was on the party, they were all expected to attend everything, all the programs. But on December 27th, Prabhupada considers Harikesh's writing assignment important enough that he has given him permission to miss some of the programs to work on it. He is applying himself very seriously to the task, and Prabhupada frequently calls him in to discuss various arguments. Today, he even had him come up during his massage to continue the discussion. Prabhupada decided to take his massage up on the roof, as it was warm and sunny. Being the highest building in the district, it affords a good view for miles around, with a gentle breeze carrying the distinct redolence of the tobacco plants. because in that area, that was what they were doing. They were cash cropping and growing up, growing tobacco, which Prabhupada commented the foolishness of that. He said here they could grow all the food that they need right on their own land, but instead they're growing a cash crop, so-called cash crop, tobacco, which then they have to send somewhere else, maybe overseas, and then the price of that is dictated, you know, by market forces that they have no control over, so they can't guarantee the return on it. And then with the money that they do get back from selling the tobacco, they buy the very food that they could have grown on their own land to start with. So Prabhupada wasn't very impressed with that. And he gave a few lectures, actually, where he mentioned about, you know, how they're wasting their time growing tobacco instead of growing their own food. Anyway, so you could smell it. It was in the air, even. So Hari Kesh came up onto the roof carrying the tape recorder. He has recently obtained a small book explaining Leninist philosophy, and using that as a basis, he and Prabhupada engaged in a lengthy discussion. Prabhupada brilliantly exposed the defects of communist ideology, showing how to defeat them at their own game of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Hari Kesh suggested, so they had a lengthy discussion, which I haven't included here, but it's in my diary. So Hari Kesh suggested at the end of the discussion that what Prabhupada had just spoken should be written as a Back to Godhead article. And Prabhupada told him, all right, so you write it. So Hari Kesh said, you completely destroy the opposition. It is very hard to say anything more. But Prabhupada agreed, but he challenged him further. He said, yes, that you have to prove. You can eulogize your Guru Maharaj, but you have to learn it and face the public and be strong to defend yourself. That is success, not by praising your Guru Maharaj. You'll praise your Guru Maharaj, that is not very difficult. But be victorious to the opposing elements. Then you'll praise your Guru Maharaj best. At home you can praise your Guru Maharaj and Guru Maharaj may be satisfied. Oh, my disciple is praising me. So that is good, that's respectful. That is the qualification. But you have to fight. Then your Guru Maharaj will be glorified. These discussions have been going on for weeks, but Prabhupada continues to prod Hari Kesh for further materialistic viewpoints, which he then promptly defeats. He's determined to challenge and destroy every philosophical obstacle to Lord Chaitanya's mission. He's always visibly inspired by such debate. At the same time, Prabhupada is making it clear that he wants to train as many men as possible to take up this task of saving the world. He concluded the discussion by asking Hari Kesh to produce a small pamphlet on the subject, urging him to print it even in Russian. Oh, in Russian, Hari Kesh said. Prabhupada said, yes, they are the greatest atheist. A dialectic spiritualism pamphlet in Russian, Hari Kesh repeated. That's big, Russian. So it was kind of interesting that Prabhupada was training him up how to defeat communist philosophy and even telling him, write the articles and get it translated into Russian. But there was no hint at that time that he was going to send Hari Kesh to Russia to do preaching there. So later on, about a week later, we were down in South India. We'd gone to a small town called Nellore. And again, the discussions were going on. So on January the 6th, Prabhupada called in Hari Kesh, and he had everyone, there were a few sannyasis there and many devotees. We were gone down there to establish a new temple, and Prabhupada had done a foundation stone ceremony. So Prabhupada called in all the sannyasis. Tamal Krishna was there, and Mahamsa Swami, Yashodhanandan Swami, and a few others. And he had everyone sit, Achyutananda was there, while Hari Kesh read out some of his pamphlet, Dialectic Spiritualism. Last night he had read it to Prabhupada for 45 minutes, and Prabhupada was very pleased with it. Prabhupada said the article should immediately be printed in Back to Godhead, as well as be sent to Hansaduta to be printed in German and Russian. Hari Kesh has used many relevant examples to disprove the theories of Lenin and Engels, most of them given by Srila Prabhupada over the last few weeks. and he has added a few of his own. He completely disproved their theory of idealistic materialism, showing it to be an illogical, nonsensical notion. So a little bit later on, then the following month, Hari Keshe actually was given sannyas. And that, I think that was on February the 5th. We were in Mayapur by that time. He'd gotten very sick, and he just became convinced that unless he went back to the West, then he wouldn't recover his health. He had some very serious digestive problems at that time. So Prabhupada gave him sannyas. Tamal Krishna Maharaj had just come on as the, or was still there as the secretary for that month. And Prabhupada discussed with him what Hari Keshe should do as his preaching engagement. So at that time, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he had the Radha Damodar Traveling Sankirtan Party, which was the most successful preaching force in ISKCON's history, even up to date. He had 100 brahmacharis, more than 100 brahmacharis, traveling all around America in 6 or 7 Greyhound buses and about a dozen maxi vans, and they were distributing phenomenal amounts of literature every month, sometimes 20,000 books a month, and collecting up to $50,000 a month, which they were putting straight into the BBT. So Prabhupada had suggested, you know, now Hari Keshe is taking sannyas, so he has to have some engagement. So why not put him in charge of one of the buses on the Radha Damodar party and let him tour around, you know, the universities and in America. So that was settled up, that was what he would do. And interestingly enough, there was another devotee, what was his name? He was from South America. And he also had come to Mayapur and with the intention of taking sannyas. Viraha Prakash, his name was. And so Prabhupada gave him and Hari Keshe sannyas. Then they came up into Prabhupada's room afterwards, and Prabhupada preached to them that now you've taken sannyas, you have to immediately go out and preach. Can't stay here even one more day. You have to immediately go and preach. And Viraha, he actually only spoke Spanish. So Ridhananda Maharaj was there. He had recommended him for sannyas. And he said to Srila Prabhupada, well, Viraha's come here, you know, because you never go to South America. So he would like to spend the next few weeks and stay here up until Gaur Purnima and just get your association, and then he's going to go back to South America to preach. And Prabhupada said, no, he has to go out immediately. Now he's a sannyasi. He must go and preach. So then he said, but he doesn't speak any English, and because he doesn't speak any Indian language either, he only speaks Spanish. So how will he preach? Prabhupada said, it doesn't matter. He said, if the house is burning down, somehow or another, you have to communicate the message. Now, Hari Keshe was also there, and, you know, he was also taking, it was an instruction to both of them. So they immediately left. The next morning, they were gone. Hari Keshe was supposed to go to America. And then, about a month later, we heard that he hadn't turned up in America. And in fact, we got a letter from him explaining that he'd just come back from Poland. Hungary it was, not Poland, Hungary. And what had happened was that he had flown to London, and he was going to stay there a couple of days and then go on to America. But as soon as he arrived in London, he met this German devotee, Alanath, and he had just gotten an invitation from a yoga club in Hungary. So these were people, they had come from Hungary and into Sweden, and they had met our devotees on the street in Sweden and bought some books. So they invited that if you ever, you know, we have our yoga club. So they told them we're also doing yoga. So they said, why don't you come and, you know, visit our yoga center in Hungary? So they sent an invitation. So Alanath was going to go there and do some preaching with them. So Hari Keshe just happened to turn up, you know, the day before he left. So he said, why don't you come with me and we'll go to Hungary and do this preaching program. So then when Hari Keshe went there, instead of going to America, he went to Hungary instead. And then, of course, when he got there, then they had this tremendous program, and it was a huge success. It was very risky, because, you know, if they were caught preaching, they couldn't sell any books or anything, then you could be jailed, and who knows where you would end up, you know, Siberia or some gulag somewhere, you know. It was very, very risky. But anyway, they went there, and the response was just incredible. He wrote this very ecstatic letter describing his experience to Srila Prabhupada, which Prabhupada got in March. So then he asked Prabhupada, should I go on to America, as was decided, or should I stay here and try to develop some preaching in Eastern Europe, in the communist countries? And so Prabhupada said, yeah, go ahead and do that. So somehow or another, you know, Prabhupada has spent like a month and a half, or 2 months nearly, training him up how to defeat all these, you know, the communist philosophy, scientific materialism. But he had not said, you know, go to Eastern Europe. In fact, he sent him in the opposite direction, back to America. But by Krishna's arrangement, he ended up in Eastern Europe. So it just seemed like the whole thing was Krishna's plan right from the very beginning, although Prabhupada didn't, you know, overtly state that you're going to be sent to, you know, preaching the communist countries. But I guess Krishna just felt that after so much effort on Prabhupada and Harikesh's part, that he wasn't going to waste it. Yeah, so he got him there. So he ended up here, and he was, you know, touring around various communist countries. In the meantime, later in 1976, Prabhupada embarked on what proved to be his last world tour. So on April the 18th, we had left Bombay, and we went down to Melbourne, then we went to Auckland, New Zealand, then we went to Fiji, then we went, Prabhupada spent the month of May in Hawaii, and then we went to Los Angeles on the 1st of June. From Los Angeles, we went to Detroit, then we went to Toronto, and then from Toronto, we came down to New Brindaban in West Virginia. So this was around June the 21st. So on June 22nd, Prabhupada got a letter from another devotee that was preaching in a very difficult part of the world. His name was Ravanari Das, and he was, I think, originally from Lebanon. So he was attempting to preach in the Middle East there. It was very, very dangerous. But he had translated Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is into Arabic. So he produced the first Arabic literature. And he was a kind of a very bold and daring fellow. Apparently, his history was that he had at one time he'd been a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. You know, they're like, you know, the guys that go around blowing everything up. But then he became a devotee. Anyway, so he wrote to Srila Prabhupada on June 22nd, and he had an idea to write Bhakti commentaries, verse for verse, on the Quran. So what he wanted to produce what he called the Vedic Quran. He said that the book in its pure form is rather Krishna conscious. He also proposed to translate into Arabic the paper on communism that Harikesh had written whilst he was still with Prabhupada earlier this year. Ravanari felt that it would be well received in Egypt, where the president of the country is said to be looking for such material. So they were trying to counteract a kind of communist insurgency there at that time. Finally, Harikesh wanted to know... Harikesh. Let's see what happened here. We were talking about Ravanari. Oh, okay, sorry. This was a letter from Harikesh, and he was describing about Ravanari. He'd met up with Ravanari. So Harikesh wrote the letter, and he was saying that this is what Ravanari wants to do. So finally, Harikesh wanted to know if he should involve himself in smuggling books into communist countries. He asked if Prabhupada felt this was foolish or necessary. Although Prabhupada kept his reply short and to the point, he was deeply satisfied to hear about their preaching efforts and the risks that they have to undergo for both his and Krishna's sake. He answered Harikesh's questions point by point. He said, there's no need to give a commentary on the Quran. There is no other religion in the world, in truth, than this Bhagavad Dharma. However, something is better than nothing. He said, the communist book that you have written, now they are saying that there are some words that may be irritating to the communists. So we've just finished a book which Hayagriva is editing at present. It is called Dialectic Spiritualism, and within that book, your comments can be added, if need be, for preaching in the Eastern European countries. So what had happened was that around about the same time that Prabhupada was training Hari Keshav to do this communist preaching, there was an opportunity for Gopal Krishna Maharaj, who was an adhikari at that time, to go to Russia and sell Prabhupada's books as a representative of the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust. Because in those days, Russia and India had a very close relationship. So Indians could easily go in and out. So Gopal Krishna, in fact, did go there, and he had a good success. He presented Prabhupada's books as, you know, the culture of India. And there was a lot of interest in Russia, in Indian culture, ancient Indian culture. So he was able to actually persuade several professors to write favorable reviews on Prabhupada's books. So when Prabhupada heard that, then he reversed his suggestion to Hari Kesh to write, you know, to put this article in Russian and then distribute it in the communist countries. Because, as he said, then, you know, there's some words there that may irritate the Russians, and then that will come back and spoil the other preaching, you know, that Gopal's doing in selling the books in the universities there. So he was very carefully trying to, you know, size up the situation. On the one hand, he said we should go there and challenge them and defeat them. But when he saw that there was another avenue that was opening up, you know, a bit more subtle, and where they were favorable, then he withdrew that instruction and told them, all right, don't agitate them. You know, let's see if we can do it the other way. So this point Prabhupada did mention that, you know, in terms of preaching, you have to be very expert. You have to know, you know, the persons that you're trying to preach to. You have to be capable of defeating, you know, all the arguments. But at the same time, you have to be able to present it in a very expert way so that people actually are willing to hear from you. So that point came up in early December of 75, when Prabhupada was still training up Hari Kesh. There was, actually this same devotee, Alanath, he was in Vrindavan, and we were having a discussion on the morning walk about defeating material scientists. It was a topic that Prabhupada came up, you know, he brought it up every single day, as far as I can remember. I don't recall practically a single day when Prabhupada didn't have some comments to make about, you know, scientific materialism and defeating, you know, atheistic philosophies like that based on science. So Prabhupada was talking. Despite his often humorous critiques and sometimes general condemnations of modern materialistic scientists, Prabhupada cautioned us that any attempt to preach on a scientific basis must be done expertly. When Alanath, a European devotee, told him of plans to publish a magazine in Sweden with articles challenging material scientists, Prabhupada warned him, "Don't write anything nonsense. It must be very solid, otherwise you will be a laughingstock. One must be confident before challenging others. In all stages, he must be able to defend himself from the opposing elements. Then such a challenge is all right. We are confident that this soul cannot be manufactured by any material combination. Therefore, we can challenge, and we can defend ourselves in any stage." So, Prabhupada often said that, "I'm not a scientist." You know, he wasn't trained as a scientist and he didn't know the scientific language. But at the same time, he could challenge any scientist because he had this complete faith, you know, in the existence of the soul and that the soul is non-material. And that, you know, you can immediately expose the flaws of material science by just challenging them. That, all right, you say life comes from matter, do it. Yeah, one of his favorite things was that, you know, a chicken can produce an egg And then that egg, after a few days only, will, you know, out will, from the egg will come another chicken. So the chicken is producing another chicken. So he said, now I challenge the scientists, if I give you, you know, some shell and something to make a shell with and the white bit and the yellow bit, you know, we'll give you all the chemicals, can you produce a chicken? And if you can't, then the chicken is a better scientist than you are. So we should give the Nobel Prize to the chicken. Yeah, like this. So he would challenge very... But he was, as he said, he was confident that the soul, in other words, the living principle is non-material. And no scientist can make the statement, yes, we can make life. It's because it's not possible. And he was also fond of quoting Swarup Damodar Maharaj, back to Swarup Damodar. Then in 1973, he had gone to a big convention of evolution. Yeah, and the whole thing was presenting evolutionary theory. So one of the keynote speakers, the Nobel Prize winner, he got up, he made this whole speech about chemical evolution. And then at the end of it, then Swarup Damodar had asked the question, if I give you all the ingredients, yeah, that make up this body, can you produce life? And the reply was, that I cannot say. So Prabhupada said, this is their bluff. They make out that it is all fact, but in when you actually challenge them, then they have nothing to say. So he said, therefore, he said, I can challenge them because I am confident. But he said, if you want to do this kind of preaching, then you have to be confident in what you say. You have to be able to challenge them, you know, in a way that you will not look foolish or fanatical, but they will accept, yes, this is science. So that was something that Prabhupada was very keen on engaging his disciples in, was, you know, defeating material science. And there are many letters that Prabhupada wrote to Swarup Damodar and Sataputta Prabhu, encouraging them that, you know, you take the... there were two areas, actually, that modern science is very doubtful about. One is the origin of life, and the other is the origin of the universe. These two areas, they have very little information. It's all speculation, actually, whatever they present. And, of course, those two things are like the main topics in the Bhagavatam. What is the living principle? And what the, you know, there's a whole cosmology that's presented in the fifth canto. And there's a whole description of the creation of the universe in the third and fourth cantos, etc. So Prabhupada was very keen to present the Vedic version of the origins of life and the origins of the universe as an alternative to material, modern material scientific understandings. For that reason, he told us that we should build this big temple in Mayapur. He said that will be the temple of the Vedic planetarium. So it's kind of like a revolutionary idea to have a temple, but inside a complete planetarium, which would show the cosmology of the Srimad Bhagavatam and present this alternative worldview. Yeah? Life comes from life, not from matter. Matter comes from life. So Prabhupada was very, very keen. That was a very essential focal point of his preaching. So Swarup Damodar, Hari Kesh, many others were engaged in that work. Now, another disciple that was engaged in writing was Gaur Govinda Maharaj. He was down in Orissa. He had gone there by himself virtually. He got this little kind of vacant plot of land. And he was living in a little hut with no electricity. And he was engaged in translating Prabhupada's books. So on the September the 6th, Prabhupada had got a letter from him. Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. This was 1976. And in his reply, Prabhupada encouraged Gaur Govinda Maharaj to continue with his writing and even glorified his isolation as being part of our tradition. He had written that, I'm sitting here alone, nobody's helping. You know, he was asking for some help. Can you send, you know, some foreign disciples? And Prabhupada wrote back, he said, preaching actually is done alone. That is the experience that we get from the previous acharyas. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was traveling alone, and with great difficulty his associates induced him to accept one assistant. So he gave practical reasons why it was not possible to send any to send more men. He said, so far foreign devotees are concerned, I can bring immediately 500 devotees from the foreign countries, but the government will not allow them to stay. If any devotee comes, he has to go back again after 3 months or 6 months at 10,000 rupees expenditure. Still, I am struggling, and whatever it is possible, I am bringing foreign devotees to preaching India. And as you say, that generally your experience is that in India they are cheaters, even though not all of them. So even Gogovind Maharaj was complaining. All the people that are, the local people, they're all cheaters, they're all crooks, like this. So he was lamenting. So Prabhupada said, the majority who come and join us, it has been experienced that they are not sincere. So under the circumstances, what can be done? I do not know. But one hope is that you were there publishing in the Aryan language, and it has been distributed, and your writing is approved by me. So, if you concentrate on these literature printing matters, and try to distribute as far as possible, that is our great success. You can construct immediately a nice temple there, but you say there are no devotees. So how temple management can be executed? So this is the problem. So you are conversant with the local language. If you bring some sincere souls to join you by preaching, then it will be successful. Just like in Europe and America, I went single-handedly, and by preaching work, the boys responded, and therefore we can see some light of success. Unfortunately, in India, this spirit is lacking. In India, generally, the young men are after women and money, and this is natural. They have no sacrificing spirit. So this is the difference. So in the 70s, that was the situation. We weren't getting so many young Indian men coming to join. A few were coming, like Lokanath Maharaj and a few others, but it was very, very slow. And especially when, you know, Prabhupada would show that this is the standard, you know, you have to give up everything and dedicate your life to Krishna consciousness, shave your head, put on a dhoti, etc., etc., then people would immediately, you know, back off. There was one funny incident that we had actually on January the 3rd, when Prabhupada was traveling from Madras, where we'd just done a two-day program at the beginning of 76. Then we were going on the train to Nellore to begin the program there. So Prabhupada, myself, Harikesh, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj, we were all in this first-class cabin. So we, I think it was about a three-hour trip. So we had breakfast in the cabin there. And, you know, there was a sliding door. You could block it off. So we had breakfast. And then Tamal Krishna Maharaj got up to go out to wash his hands. So as soon as he opened the door, he kind of, you know, squeezed out and then shut it, you know, really quickly. And then he came back after 5 or 10 minutes after he'd washed, and he did the same thing. He opened the door and squeezed in and then shut the door really quick, and we were looking at him, what's going on? And then he said, there are three men out here, and they're hanging around. They, you know, they want to try to get in to see Srila Prabhupada. So he said, they're just going to come in and waste time, that's all. They'll just come in and ask for some, you know, ashibabs, and, you know, that'll be it. Then, you know, they'll just waste Prabhupada's time. So just keep them out. So me and Harikesh both went out and we washed. And then we came. But when we opened the door, somehow or another, one of them, he got his head round the corner. And he caught Prabhupada's eye. And of course, as soon as the eye contact was made, that was it. Then you have to let them in. Because you know they're there, and you know, they know that you know that they're there. So you can't really refuse them. So, you know, they got in. So Prabhupada said, all right, let them in. So they came in and sat down opposite Srila Prabhupada. And then so Prabhupada, you know, asked them a few questions. You know, what are your names? Where are you from? Like this. And then Prabhupada said, so what can I do for you? So then they said, well, Swamiji, we just wanted to get your blessings. It was exactly what we'd been discussing, right? We just want to get your blessings. So then Prabhupada sat there. And he just completely straight, he just said, so what are those blessings? So then they didn't know what to say. Nobody had ever asked them before, you know, what blessings do they want? So then one of them, he said, well, Swamiji, he said, I have this bad knee. Right? And then we kind of groaned. It was myself and, you know, Tamal and Harikesh. We just, oh, you know. So he realized that that's not the right, you know. So he said, and of course he said, for our family and friends as well. So when then we groaned again. So then finally, and he said, he was getting like confused, and then he said, and of course for all the peoples like this. And then he trailed off into silence. So then Prabhupada looked at him. He said, this is my blessing. And he pointed to, you know, us. Two, you know, like brahmacharya, sannyasi, were there with our shaved heads and tilak and, you know, japamala and everything. He said, this is my blessing. He said, are you prepared to accept such a blessing? And the man kind of, he nearly had a fit. He didn't know what to say. You know, nobody had ever, you know, challenged him like that. And he knew what it meant. You know, his is, you know, sannyasis, they've given up everything, you know. And he said, oh, well, he said, actually, I don't think that we're ready yet for, you know, we have our families and our jobs and we can't give up, you know, like this. And then, you know, they stood up and then they excused themselves and they were out of there like a shot, you know. It was very funny, actually, to watch it. And Prabhupada just sat there and watched the, you know, watched the whole thing. And then after they'd gone, he just laughed like anything. He said, this is the problem. He said, they think that a saintly person is just a cheap way of getting a medical problem solved. That's all. Right? Oh, we don't have to pay any money to go to the doctor. We just go to the sadhu and he'll give some blessing and then our knee will be, or whatever, it'll be okay. He said, this is the problem. He said, they are not serious about spiritual life. So this was Prabhupada's general observation at that time in India. And for a long time, actually. He said that when he was preaching in the 1950s, he'd gone to Jhansi, and he tried to start something there. He used to go out on padyatra sometimes. He would walk to different villages in the surrounding area. And he would preach, he would meet big people also. And he would ask them, you know, he got some rich man, who he may have several sons, and he would say, why don't you give me one of your sons and I'll train him how to be a, you know, brahmachari and a brahmana and to preach Krishna consciousness. And then they would say, oh Swamiji, what we need now is technology. Like this. Even in the 50s they were saying technology. So in that way Prabhupada couldn't get anything started and he couldn't get any response. Nobody was willing. And then when he came to the West, of course, then so many young men immediately came and joined. They gave up everything, or they'd already given up everything, and they came and joined and took up Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada, you know, he would often make this point that these Westerners, they've given up everything, but the Indians won't do that. He said, because of this family attachment. He told us actually in Nellore, he said the reason why is because they're so much attached to the family. So he said the Westerners, although they're hippies and they have so many other, you know, problems with drugs or whatever, but he said that is what their one good quality or the one advantage. He said they have no attachment for family life. So he said therefore it's easy for them to take up Krishna consciousness. Anyway, so Gaur Govinda Maharaji was complaining. But Prabhupada told him, just, you're doing your writing, that is approved by me. You go out, sell some books, but you have to make, you know, some devotees in the local area. We can't send people to you. You either do it or not. But that's it. So, another devotee that Prabhupada engaged in writing was Sasrut Maharaj, of course. And he had already written, let's see, in 76, he was writing a book called Readings in Vedic Literature, which was approved by Prabhupada. That was a book which gave an overview of, you know, Vaishnava and impersonalism, like a general overview of Vedic philosophy, where he explained something about the three stages of God realization. And he also included in that the verses from the Ishapanishad and the verses from the Bhagavad Gita. And he gave an overview of karma, reincarnation, and all these general principles. And he had written that due to the request of several professors that he had met when he was doing his college preaching tours. He was very active at that time. I remember he wrote a letter to Prabhupada in January of 76, and he informed Prabhupada that he had 100 preaching engagements in the month of February alone, just in the state of Texas, in all the universities there. So sometimes he was doing 3 lectures a day, just traveling around all the different universities. So it was quite popular. But he saw that there was a need, you know, to present Vedic philosophy. There were a lot of misunderstandings and confusion. So he wrote this book, Readings in Vedic Literature, which Prabhupada liked a lot and approved of. So in June of 76, I mentioned that we went to Detroit, and Satsrup Maharaj was there. He was in charge of the library party. So he had about a half a dozen men. They were touring around all the universities and selling Prabhupada's books, standing orders to the library, libraries and universities. So one evening on June 13th, Prabhupada called in Satsrup at about 10 o'clock at night. And he suggested that Satsrup write a book on the theme that all endeavor is a failure without Krishna. Their discussion lasted nearly an hour. Satsrup Maharaj has already completed his work on his new book for the colleges, and that is expected to come out this year. So he said, why don't you write a book explaining how no endeavor can be successful unless it's connected to Krishna? And then another occasion when he gave him an instruction for writing was the following year. Maybe you can put something in a mouth or something, or yeah, some food or a dummy or something. Satsrup Maharaj came to be with Prabhupada for the month of January, or kind of he came in towards late January. Rameshwar had come in for the first 3 weeks of January 77, and then Satsrup Maharaj joined Prabhupada as his secretary when he was in Bhubaneswar in late January. And on the 25th and 26th of January, Prabhupada went to Jagannath Puri. It was interesting actually how he got there, because Prabhupada had previously said that he would not go back to Jagannath Puri. The last time he'd been there was in 1958. And he said, I won't go to Jagannath Puri unless they allow my disciples into the temple there. So we had gone to Bhubaneswar, where Gogovinda Maharaj had this plot of land. And he had invited Prabhupada, please come, we'll have the foundation stone ceremony on Lord Nityananda's appearance day, which was in early February. So Prabhupada had gone there, because he made a condition. He said, you have to get the electricity on, otherwise I'm not going. Not because he wanted comfort, but because he wanted to continue with his translation work. And he said, I can't use my dictaphone unless you have electricity, and if I can't write, I'm not going. So Gogovinda Maharaj got that arranged. And then we went there, maybe around about the 20th of January. So when we got there, it was kind of like this desolate piece of land. It's just like brown, scrubby earth, nothing growing for miles around. The whole place was vacant. And the only advantage of it was right on the side of the main highway, which was, you know, the highway that came down from Calcutta all the way down south. So it was just kind of on the side there, highway number 5. And other than that, he had this little brick cottage with a thatched roof. There was just a dividing wall in the middle of it, which wasn't even going up to the ceiling. And then another little brick place where he was using as a temple. And he was just living there by himself. So anyway, Prabhupada came there, and several sannyasis came. Bhavananda was there, and Gagamuni Swami came as well. He had his Indian library party. They came. They were living in tents at the side of the land. So when we saw the land, nobody was enthusiastic at all. You know, we all thought, you know, why is he here? And even, you know, the main part of Bhubaneswar was a little further away. So nobody was kind of impressed, but except Srila Prabhupada. And he, you know, was encouraging Gaur Govinda Maharaj, you know, you stay here, you know, you develop a temple here. He said later on, he said, this will become an important place. He liked the situation, although we couldn't see it, but Prabhupada had that view. And of course, later on, it did in fact become an important place. And if you go there now, what was, you know, miles of just open, barren land at that time is now completely packed up with, you know, housing estates and office buildings and etc. And it's become actually, you know, like the hub of Bhubaneswar where our temple is. Anyway, at that time we couldn't see it, but Prabhupada encouraged Gaur Govinda Maharaj. He was the only one that was enthusiastic about the place. But Gagamuni, he told Srila Prabhupada that he knew of some plots of land that were for sale in Jagannath Puri. And we were all thinking, you know, why are we building something in Bhubaneswar when Puri is just, you know, an hour away? Jagannath Puri is a much more important place. So Gagamuni persuaded Srila Prabhupada that there's some plots of land, you know, even if we can't get into the main temple, we could build our own temple, and then that would be worth going. So then Prabhupada agreed, all right, he said, if you've got some places, then we'll go and see. So on January the 25th, we actually drove to Jagannath Puri, and we looked at several plots of land on the seafront and different places. And then Prabhupada told, you know, Gagamuni to go ahead and see if he could negotiate to get something. Anyway, what happened was in the afternoon, we had stayed there for the day. We were going to go back in the evening. And this fellow turned up. His name was Sarasiva Rutt. So he was a pujari from the main temple. But he was actually favorable to our devotees. He knew Bhagwat Das, who was stationed in Bhubaneswar. And he heard Prabhupada was in Puri. And he had a pandal the next day where he was inaugurating somebody's translation of or commentary on the Bhagavatam. Just a single book, small book. So he came to Prabhupada and he asked him, will you come to the inauguration of my book? We're having that tomorrow. I have a pandal and please come and speak. So then Prabhupada was happy to oblige him. And so we ended up staying overnight and most of the next day. So in the morning of the next day, Prabhupada was sitting, we were staying in this motel, like a beach hotel. And I think it was called Tourist Bungalow Number 1. So Prabhupada was staying upstairs in one of the rooms. And in the morning then Prabhupada called for Satswarup and Pradyumna. And then he sat and discussed with them for about an hour about producing new works. And he suggested that they work on Padma Purana, Vishnu Purana, various Upanishads, and different other Vedic literatures, which he said he was not going to have enough time to do himself, but he would have done if he had had the time. So then he suggested to Satswarup Maharaj that because he was good at English, and Pradyumna because he was a Sanskrit scholar, so he said the two of you, you can combine together and you can bring these books out. So that was an instruction that Prabhupada left, you know, for future publications, and he said the BBT would publish them. Somehow or another, of course, they didn't get that together so well. But nowadays we have other devotees like Gopi Puranadana Prabhu. He's just come out with the Brihad Bhagavat Amrita, and he's working on various other books as well. So something's going on, but that was approved by Srila Prabhupada. He wanted to see his disciples continue on with the tradition, you know, translating and commentating and presenting these transcendental literatures. So then another devotee that Prabhupada gave some encouragement for writing, this man was, his name was Eugene Stansky. And he had been a Catholic priest for something like 25 years. And then he met the devotees and he was very impressed with what we were doing. And then he decided that actually Krishna consciousness was really the spiritual substance, that he'd been looking for a long time. So he left his Catholic monastery and he came and, stayed with the devotees. He met Prabhupada in early June of 76 when he was in Los Angeles. He had a darshan. And then he actually joined Satsrup Maharaj's library party and he began traveling with them because they were preaching in the colleges. And I think maybe he had a PhD or something like that. And he was like a scholarly man, so it seemed like it was a good situation for him. So he came to see Prabhupada again on June 14th, when Prabhupada was in Detroit. So he had some questions to ask, and he wanted Prabhupada's approval for a writing project that he is planning. He said he was very happy about traveling with Satsrup Maharaj's party. Eugene asked if he could keep a daily log of his activities for the year, with the aim of writing a book explaining the transition from Roman Catholic priesthood to Krishna consciousness. It would be written, he told Prabhupada, for the college student, with the basis of solid philosophical principles rather than mere sentiment. I think this would open the door to all of the colleges and universities across the country, he said. Prabhupada was enthusiastic. Eugene is a PhD and has joined us not out of sentiment or whim, but by solidly understanding our philosophy. The chance to penetrate the universities appealed to Srila Prabhupada, and he mentioned recent successes in Hamburg, where his books have been accepted as texts for learning Sanskrit. He encouraged Eugene to do it. So you have kindly come to join us, he said. You study our philosophy very minutely, then try to do something for the suffering humanity. The saintly persons, at least in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement, they are not meant for being idle. They are always busy for the welfare of the whole human society, and this is the sign of a saintly person. So he gave some approval for that, but I don't think that he ever completed that. I think that he found living with the devotees to be a little too difficult. They were out on the road, of course, and in those days, the brahmacharis, I don't think anybody was older than about 25 on that party, and Eugene was about 50-something, so he found it a little difficult, being with a completely different generation. And plus, they were living very austerely. In those days, nobody slept in a bed. We all slept on the floor in sleeping bags, etc. So it was a bit tough. And being on the road also, they would shower and everything out in some garage or something or whatever. So he didn't last that long, as far as I know. So we never saw that book. But it's interesting that Prabhupada approved it as a project. It was an interesting angle, that transition from being a Roman Catholic priest to becoming a Krishna conscious devotee. Then another devotee that Prabhupada encouraged to in his writing, his name was Dhamma Jakshadas. He used to write very often for Back to Godhead, and he wrote some brilliant articles actually. So on May the 27th, 1976, Prabhupada got a letter from Dhamma Jaksha, who is a Back to Godhead staff writer, enclosing a pamphlet entitled Simple Living and High Thinking. It has been especially prepared for mass distribution at a United Nations conference called Habitat, which is to be held in Vancouver from the end of May until mid-June. Guru Das and Ribhati Nandan Swamis, along with others, will be overseeing a pandal and an exhibition of ours called the Vedic Habitat. Prabhupada liked the idea very much, and on his walk this morning, he said that the UN should be informed of this principle, that God is the father and material nature is the mother of all living entities. Then every living being, including the dogs, trees and others, can be seen as the sons and daughters of the same father and mother. The preaching should be that this is the grand solution to all of mankind's troubles. So that was a good article that he wrote, and that actually appeared in one of the Back to Godhead issues during that year. I think maybe the one that came out in July. I mentioned previously in when we were in Leicester that that year was the 200th anniversary of American independence, and Prabhupada had been invited to go to Washington to our temple there for the July 4th celebration. And the devotees, they made a special magazine about American independence, but they called, the lead article was called Declaring Our Dependence on God. So they were declaring independence, and our article was Declaring Our Dependence. And Prabhupada liked that very much. And Dharmajaksha's article appeared in that issue. So if you've got the folio, yeah, then Prabhupada's archived books and everything, it's all on this folio program. You'll find there that all the BTGs are there, and you can look that up. Very, very good article about Varnashram Dharma and that principle of simple living and high thinking. I need a drink. Does anybody have any questions or comments up to this point? Yes, Prabhu.
What did Prabhupada expect from a writer of Krishna consciousness?
What did he expect from a writer? In what regard?
Did he give any specific instructions that... He's given instructions to specific devotees about what they should write, but anything about how they should write or how they should present?
How means?
What should be the presentation? Like, one of the things you mentioned was that Prabhupada said that when Gopal Krishna Maharaj went to Russia, he said that don't put out aggressive articles against communism now because it's not required.
Mm-hmm.
But say if we were to write articles, say I'm a doctor, I'm a psychiatrist, and if I plan to write something about Krishna consciousness, what would be the basic requisite or what would be the expectation?
Well, Prabhupada encouraged devotees to write from their own experience. And just like with the devotees that were involved at that time with the Bhaktivedanta Institute, in 76 that was when the institute was actually officially put together. And Sarup Damodar, Sataputta, there was Madhavadas, and there were several, Rabindra Sarup, he was doing his PhD at that time in religions. Sataputta had a PhD in pure mathematics. Sarup Damodar, his was in some biology, some aspect of biology. So Prabhupada encouraged them to use their scientific expertise, but to prove the existence of God. In fact, actually, one time he did tell them, he said, if you can just prove that we are not the body, that will be enough. Even if you don't tell them about Krishna or anything, but said, if you can just prove that we're not the body, that will be enough, because that will finish material science. You know, the whole idea of chemical evolution. So Prabhupada, he told them, you challenge them. But as we heard earlier on there, he said, you can't do that unless you're expert. You know, if you try to do it and you're not expert, then you'll be a laughingstock. Then people won't take you seriously. I'll give you an example of a practical example that a few years back, Sataputta Prabhu was ready actually to present a Vedic planetarium. He'd been working for years on the fifth canto, and he'd figured out how to present the planetary systems and everything according to the Bhagavatam. And so we had petitioned the GBC to make a science museum, like a medium-sized science museum, and we were going to have a planetarium in there and everything. They gave us the approval, but somehow or another the funding that we had dried up. Otherwise we would have done it. But anyway, around about that time I read an article in Time magazine about a Vedic planetarium in Gujarat. I just forget the exact place. But it was being run by, I'm not sure if it wasn't devotees from the Pushti Marg. Anyway, some group, and they'd built the Vedic planetarium. So there was a one-page article. The reporter had gone there, you know, to see what they had to offer, and when in the course of the interviews, they found that the people that were running the place didn't know anything, you know, about what they were presenting. They had no scientific explanation. Just they were blindly attempting to present what they'd read in some Purana somewhere. But they had no scientific explanation. And, you know, the whole article just ridiculed them and made them, you know, appear to be completely, you know, like idiots, religious fanatics, you know, presenting some, you know, old, you know, antiquated, you know, mythological understandings of, you know, the universe, and it's like Hercules or something, you know, or Atlas carrying the world on his head or something, you know. That, and they just lampooned them because they didn't know anything about what they were trying to present. So we have to present, you know, a Vedic planetarium, but we have to do it in such a way that it will be taken very seriously. Just like this book, Forbidden Archaeology, you know, Drudakama Prabhu, he spent years researching that. And when they presented it, it's so solid, it's such a strong challenge, but on the basis of science, you know, discoveries by scientists themselves, that it's very difficult for them to refute it. And as a result of that, it's caused a sensation in a lot of scholarly circles. So Drudakama himself is not, you know, he doesn't have a degree. He didn't complete his university education. But he's done such a presentation that he's invited to go on and speak in many universities all around the world. And he's taken very, very seriously. So if you want to, you know, preach, then use your expertise as a, what, psychologist or psychiatrist? Psychiatrist. Use their expertise, you know, to present Krishna consciousness, but in, you know, within the framework of what you've been trained. Then it will be very, very effective. People will take you seriously. You're a professional man. You know the language. And you know, as a devotee, the flaws in, you know, the processes that are described through your particular scientific discipline. Just like Srila Prabhupada, he could, you know, meet with a scientist, and they'd go on and on about this and that, and Prabhupada would immediately, within 5 minutes, he knew exactly what the flaws were and where the shortcomings were, and then he'd hone in on that and expose it. And then they'd just dry up. They had nothing more to say. And Prabhupada wasn't a scientist, but he, you know, he knew the flaws and he exposed them, and that's what you have to do. You have to show the limitations. So, you know, there's a methodology there. And if you do it very nicely, very expertly, you know, it will be a very substantial contribution. So Prabhupada never encouraged the devotees to write beyond their own realizations. He always said, whatever you know, you write on that, that's all. But you link it up with Krishna consciousness. Yeah? Is that alright?
Yes.
Alright. You know, the whole field of consciousness and understanding what consciousness is, what the brain is, you know, it's a complete mystery. All they do is speculate. They have no idea what's really going on and what it is that animates the brain and, you know, gives us cognition and all these things. They can't explain that. But we can, from the Gita and from the Bhagavatam. Any other questions before we go on? Yes?
It looks as though Prabhupada was always itching for a fight with the materialists.
Yeah. Yeah, Prabhupada knew. Preaching is fighting. That's what it is.
And he was ready to take any and every opportunity to defeat them.
Yeah, Prabhupada was an opportunist. He said that actually when Sasrut was with him in Bhubaneswar in 77. He said, we're opportunists. Any chance, any little, you know, entry point to get in and present Krishna consciousness. He would seize on that immediately. So, you know, you don't there's no preaching going on in the spiritual world. Everybody's already convinced. You know, preaching means that you have to fight. There's opposing elements, and you have to be prepared to face them. And sometimes, you know, it can get very contentious, as we've discovered. You know, we have so many challenges in presenting Krishna consciousness. But if you accept the challenge, then you become strengthened by it yourself. It's exciting.